a sticky dread. Like he had overslept on a winter day and woken up to discover it was already dark. He didn't want to be alone. Not today.
What are you two doing tonight?
They exchanged another glance.
We have dinner with our families,
Eddie said. He waited for the bus to Westlake Park after his last class of the day. Young would be working late tonight, or at a business dinner. One night he had taken Daniel to his factory, and Daniel had looked down from the executive office at rows of women at sewing machines.
Your mother doesn't like to visit me at work,
Young said. Once or twice a week, Daniel took the bus out to Leon's place to eat with him and Shuang. He played with Yimei in the park, showing her how to toss a frisbee and do wheelies on her bike, and wished she were his real sister, or at least his real cousin. When he mentioned these visits to his mother, she said,
Maybe I'll come with you sometime.
But tonight Leon was also busy. He'd said he had to work late. Now that Daniel was making money again, he had started to pay Angel back, little by little. He had cut up his credit card and was chipping away at the balance. But whatever extra he had left over, which wasn't a lot, he sent to her. She never responded, but deposited the money. He hadn't heard from Roland either. The last time he had Googled Psychic Hearts, several weeks ago, he had read a review of their latest show with the headline, Don't Believe the Hype. While guitarist Nate Lundstrom, a former member of a number of Melancholia projects, is technically and stylistically astute, Psychic Hearts' new, dancier configuration lacks the claustrophobic, manic-depressive, and almost mystical cohesion of its original pairing. The looping beats have gotten frayed and agonizingly repetitive, and Fuente's howls grown stale, like a fifth-rate lightning bolt meets bubblegum pop. How can something so heavy sound so damn minimal? Sure, it's cool, kids, but there's no there there.
The bus arrived. Of course, all the passengers were Chinese. It had taken him weeks to not find it surprising that everyone around him, including the people on TV, including the hottest girls, were all Chinese. Being from America made him an object of desire, which was both flattering and strange. Girls flirted with him when they found out he was from New York. Even Tammy, who had a boyfriend, walked a little too close when they went to lunch. He'd hooked up a couple times with a girl who'd gone to high school with one of the other world-top teachers, a sales manager at a company that manufactured plastic slippers. There was another girl, too, a friend of a friend of Eddie's, who lived in the suburbs with her parents and texted him sporadically. There was a comfort in belonging that he'd never felt before. Yet somehow, he still stood out. The bus driver eyed him for a beat too long when he bought the ticket, as did the woman in the seat across the aisle, a bag of groceries on her lap. Young and his mother assured him his Chinese sounded close to normal now and not as freakish as it had when he first arrived. But Daniel figured it was his clothes, his bearing, or the way he looked or walked or held himself, something that revealed he wasn't from here. Even if he encouraged them to ask questions, he often grew tired of the students and other teachers at World Top finding him a source of perpetual fascination. His students asked him why he was so tall, even if Eddie was taller than him, and prodded him to sing songs to them in English. When the other teachers asked what he did for fun and he said he liked to walk around and listen to music on his headphones, they laughed. He called his mother to see if there was a chance she would be home for dinner. And when she didn't pick up, he didn't bother to leave a message. He shouldn't have to ask her to be home tonight. If she forgot what day it was, He would know what to do. God, he hoped she hadn't forgotten.
He plugged his headphones into his phone, feeling rubbery as the music kicked in. A mix of old favorites. Suicide, Arthur Russell, Queens of the Stone Age. His phone buzzed and he expected to see his mother's name, but it was a wrong number. A guy who said in Mandarin,
I thought this was someone else.
It was stupid being here again, waiting for her, disappointed by her.
He had thoroughly searched the apartment when he was there alone, combed through the drawers and cabinets, even scoured beneath the beds and leather couch. Finally, his mother had the nice couch she'd always wanted, but found only clothes, folded and neat, a binder with documents pertaining to work in the apartment. He was looking for hidden facts, a sign that would point him toward what he should do next. Yet there was not a single photograph in the apartment. No squirreled-away shoebox of sentimental keepsakes. No hidden diaries or items that could confess any aspects of his mother and Yong beyond what they portrayed to him. They existed only in the present. Their lives as brand new as their apartment. He had hoped this would allow him to trust them. But still, he worried. Didn't want to be left the fool. The woman across the aisle was staring at him openly, and he noticed the tension in his jaw, how tightly he was squeezing his hands. He turned the music louder, but couldn't regain that initial rush. Apprehension lingered. The fear he was letting somebody down. That he was the one who was being let down. At the apartment gate, carrying a bag of takeout from a restaurant near the bus stop, Daniel greeted Chun, the security guard.
Have a good night,
Chun said, and smiled. Daniel used his key to open the front door of the building and rode the elevator up to the 12th floor. He stopped before switching on the light, was in the process of using one foot to loosen the heel of the other shoe when he heard a scuffle along the floor.
Who's there?
He said. And a second later, the lights were blazing and there was a chorus of people shouting, Surprise! His mother was at his side, and Yong, and a blur of other faces. She hadn't forgotten his birthday. Not only had she remembered, of course she'd remembered, how could he have thought she hadn't? But she had filled the apartment with everyone he knew in Fuzhou. Eddie and Tammy and the other teachers at Worldtop. His Speed English Now students. Her and Yong's friends. Even Leon and Shuang and Yimei were there. The living room was crowded. Balloons tied to the chairs. And there was food on the counter. Platters of fruit, grilled meat and noodles. Music was switched on. Someone put a beer in his hand. It was a real party.
Were you surprised? His mother asked. People thought it was strange when I said we were having a surprise party. I remember seeing it in a movie once.
Tammy and Eddie kept it a surprise when I had lunch with them, and my students didn't say a thing.
She laughed.
I said I'd get them fired if they said one word to you.
Daniel looked around the room again. People sat on the couch, eating chips and peanuts, while others drank beers in the kitchen.
You don't like crowds, though, he said.
I don't mind.
You don't like parties.
That's not true. I used to love parties.
Used to.
Now, too.
You invited Leon.
I wanted everyone here who's important to you.
He called me the other day and we talked for a little while. I met his wife. His daughter. She sounded genuinely glad about it.
Thank you, he said. Happy birthday, Deming.
She patted his arm.
My son. The future director of World Top English.
Well,
Daniel said.
It's true. I don't see Boss Chung here tonight.
He wandered around the apartment, stopping to talk to people. Pop music with auto-tuned Mandarin shot out from a pair of portable speakers.
Shuang and his mother's friend Ning were dancing with Tammy,
the two older women following Tammy's more intricate steps.
Leon and Yimei were talking with Yong in the kitchen, and Yong waved him over.
Let's take a picture.
Daniel grinned, hot and buzzy.
Send me a copy, he said, and put his arms around Yimei,
Leon behind him, as Yong snapped pictures with his phone.
Do you have anything to draw with?
Yimei asked. He wondered if they looked alike in any way, even if they weren't related.
I don't have crayons, but I have paper and pens. Let me go look.
In his mother's guest room, which had become his bedroom, his laptop was furiously dinging. He pressed a key and the screen came to life, flooding him with messages from Ridgeboro and New York City, even Potsdam. Michael had sent a video of him and Timothy and Vivian singing Happy Birthday in their kitchen in Sunset Park. Roland emailed,
Happy birthday, Dee. Miss you.
Even Cody messaged,
When are you coming home?
Daniel read the messages, one by one, read them again. There were so many of them, and seeing them made him giddy with sadness. He hadn't been forgotten. From the living room came a round burst of laughter, and he remembered why he had come into the room. He rooted through a pile of papers, pushing aside the visa application he had promised his mother he would fill out by last week, and found a notepad and a few pens for Yimei. He was about to close his laptop when a new window popped up. P.K. Wilkinson is calling, the window announced. Another window appeared with an accompanying message. Daniel, are you there? The window pulsed and glowed. He crossed the room and shut the door, muffling the party, then sat on the bed and clicked. Kay and Peter's faces appeared, squinting into their computer screen. They were in the study in Ridgeboro. He recognized the bookshelves, the blue wallpaper, the framed diplomas and awards. Daniel? Kay said.
Where are you? Peter asked.
In Fuzhou.
China.
They were talking over each other. There was a split-second delay, so Daniel saw their mouths moving before he heard their voices, and their motions lagged a little. Pixelated smears of color trailing their faces. He heard Kay say, China? And Peter say,
Happy birthday.
Daniel shouted into the screen. His English sounded naughty, peculiar.
I'm staying with my mom, my birth mom. I'm fine. I'm working. Teaching English. I haven't been gambling. My Chinese is great now. I mean, it's back.
Kay's face was on the verge of crumpling.
We wanted to wish our son a happy birthday, she said.
He felt his eyes well up.
What time is it over there?
Peter asked.
8 at night.
Daniel could hear the music from the living room. He wanted to stay and talk. But he didn't want to miss out.
They're throwing me a party here. How are you guys doing?
Kay said she had run into Cody at the Food Lion the other day. Peter said he had watched a Tom Petty concert from 1980 on YouTube. Daniel told them he was the favorite teacher at World Top English.
You may have found your calling,
Peter said.
Are you going to come home? To America? Kay asked.
I don't know.
You know you are always welcome here, Kay said.
Christmas is coming up,
Peter said.
He swallowed.
I'll have to see.
He heard footsteps outside.
Coming!
His mother called from the hallway.
Where are you?
Just a minute,
he said in Fujianese. But the door opened and light and voices spilled into the room, and it was too late to cut the call short. He turned and saw his mother in the doorway.
The cake is ready,
she said. As Peter and Kay watched, she picked up the visa form, which had fallen on the bed.
You still haven't filled this out?
She looked over him, at his computer. And Daniel could see her face on the small screen that reflected what Peter and Kay saw on theirs. His face. And her face. Next to each other. Looking into the camera together. He saw Peter's expression move from confusion to recognition. Kay's mouth hesitated for a moment before she caught herself and smiled.
Kay and Peter? This is my mother, Polly.
Hello, his mother said in English. It is very nice to meet you, Polly, Kay said, pressing her lips together.
He thought he detected a slowness in her words that wasn't usually there. The three of them studied one another as Daniel tried to think of the right thing to say.
You do look alike, Peter said. I can see it.
Thank you for taking care of Daniel, Kay said. He must be having the time of his life in China.
His mother nodded, staring at the screen, and Daniel noticed her teeth clench.
He wanted to protect her. But from what?
When she had told him about Ardsleyville, he'd remembered what Leon had said. That there was something broken in her. He wasn't sure if she didn't understand Kay and Peter, or if she didn't have the English words to respond, or if she didn't know what to say. But he wanted her to say something. Anything. For her to be as loud and demanding and opinionated as she usually was. He hated that he could see her the way Peter and Kay must be seeing her. A mute Chinese woman with a heavy accent. Their tense smiles were making him angry.
I should get back to the party,
he said in English.
Okay, Kay said. We'll talk to you soon, Daniel.
And maybe we'll see you at Christmas, Peter said. Maybe we can help pay for a plane ticket.
His mother leaned over, blocking his face on the screen, and said, in English,
His name is Deming, not Daniel.
Daniel nearly laughed out loud. He bit the inside of his lip.
Then Kay's smile dropped, and he felt the need to apologize to her and Peter. Or should he apologize to his mother instead? He said goodbye and logged out of the program. In the living room, his friends were waiting with a cake, and his mother lit the candles and he blew out the flames, then looked up to see Leon and Yong, Eddie and Tammy, Shuang and Yimei. The sound of their clapping was a shimmering yellow, and the sound of his mother saying his name.
Deming!
The warmest gold. He collected plates and spoons, empty bottles of Qingdao, tied up the trash bags, vacuumed crumbs from the rug, swept the kitchen floor. If he kept busy, he could ward off the possibility of his mother asking him about Peter and Kay. He didn't want to go to Carlo. He didn't want to present papers at the conference for English educators. Peter and Kay had supported him, in their own way. So why did he feel angry with them?
But he couldn't let his mother down either. Because while he had been playing video games with Roland and listening to Hendrix, she had been in a prison camp. She still had nightmares. At the very least, he didn't want to make her feel bad. Everyone had stories they told themselves to get through the days. Like Vivian's belief that she had helped him. His mother insisting she had looked for him. That she could forget about him because he was okay. In the hotel room in Beijing, he had wanted to hurt her when he told the truth about Vivian paying off her debt. So then he had gifted her with a lie. That he never called Kay Mom. "I saw this in your room." She came into the kitchen in her pajamas, holding the visa form. "You must have forgotten to fill it out."
"Leave it on the table," he said,
scrubbing a stain on the counter.
"I'll take care of it later. Wasn't it funny when Eddie and my students sung that happy birthday song and wrote new lyrics so it had my name? I didn't know Eddie had such a good voice, or that Tammy was such a good dancer."
"Stop scrubbing. I'll clean up later."
"We drank so much beer. No wonder the neighbors were telling us to keep it quiet."
"Sit down. Let me do it."
"You threw me a party."
"Because I wanted to. You don't have to repay me." She took an orange from one of the plates of leftovers and brought it to the kitchen table.
He put the sponge down and watched her peel it, rubbing the rind away with her fingernail, separating the wedges onto a plate, half for her, half for him. He stood over her shoulder and hugged her from behind. Surprised, she held his arms in her hands. Over the years, he had thought about what his life would have been like if Mama and Leon hadn't left. If Vivian hadn't taken him to the foster care agency. It was like watching water spread across dry pavement. Lines going in all directions. Peter and Kay might have adopted another boy. He could be living in Sunset Park. Or in the Bronx, or Florida, or someplace he'd never heard of. He had imagined his doppelgangers living the lives he hadn't. In different apartments, and houses, and cities, and towns. With different sets of parents. Different languages. But today he could only see himself where he was right now. The particular set of circumstances that had trickled down to this particular life. That would keep trickling in new directions. He sat down. His mother passed him the visa form and a pen.
"I'm going to send it out tomorrow."
He took an orange slice. All this time, he'd been waiting for his real life to begin. Once he was accepted by Roland's friends and the band made it big. Once he found his mother. Then things would change. But his life had been happening all along. In the jolt of the orange juice on his tongue, or how he dreamt in two languages. How his students' faces looked when they figured out the meaning of a new word. The wisp of smoke as he blew out his birthday candles. The surge and turn and crunch of a perfect melody.
"You're going to New York for Christmas?"
his mother said.
"To your adoptive family?"
"No, of course not."
"They call you all the time?"
"I haven't spoken to them since I came here. This was the first time."
"They want you to come home, though."
He was like Tammy, unable to meet his mother's eyes.
"This is my home."
"So you're going to stay? With me?"
It was a funny thing. Forgiveness. You could spend years being angry with someone and then realize you no longer felt the same. That your usual mode of thinking had slipped away when you weren't noticing. He could see, in the flash of worry in his mother's face as she waited for his reply. Like he had heard in Kay and Peter's shaking voices when they said goodbye to him earlier. That in the past few months,
His fear of being unwanted had dissipated.
Because Mama and Kay and Peter were trying to convince him that they were deserving of his love, not the other way around.
He ate the bite of orange, took the visa form and uncapped the pen, scanning the paper for where he was supposed to sign.
Part 4. The Leavers.
20. In the spring, 4 months after you left, I left too. Not just Fuzhou, but my life. Yong, my job, our apartment, everyone I knew. I decided to move to Hong Kong. While you were staying with me, I had pretended we had never been apart, that Ardsleyville had never happened. But when you left Fuzhou, I understood that I could also leave. And maybe it wasn't too late. It was a short flight to Hong Kong, less than 2 hours. And by the time I had gotten used to being up in the air, the flight attendants were already preparing to land. At the airport, I rolled my suitcase, a small one containing all I had packed, through immigration. Then onto a train that took me into the center of the city. I exited onto a street outside a mall, where the cars drove on the left side of the road, not the right. It took me several tries to cross. Even at night, there were still crowds out. People talking in Cantonese, signs flashing in Chinese and English. I had the address of the one-room apartment I'd rented, sight unseen. And tomorrow morning I would start my new job at a school in Kowloon. At the ferry terminal, I bought a ticket, then found a place on the upper deck. The boat rocked in the waves, and as I saw the lights of Kowloon come through the fog, I held the railing, breathless with laughter. How wrong I had been to assume this feeling had been lost forever. This light-headed uncertainty, all my fear and joy. I could return here, punching the sky. Because I had found her. Polly Guo. Wherever I went next, I would never let her go again. The breeze blew my hair back, then forward. The water was Minjiang, New York, Fuzhou, but most of all it was you. I thought of the last time you and I had gone to the water together in New York. The summer before I was taken to Ardsleyville. Late August. Afternoon edging into evening. The heat lessening its grip. We had walked to a bridge over the Harlem River, spanning the Bronx and Manhattan. The air was soft and thick, and the walkway swayed as cars drove past. The river below was brown and muddy. Weeds stood in the middle of the bridge. You were 10, almost 11. Already you preferred your friend's company to mine. I had to bribe you with a candy bar to get you away from the TV. I pointed to a building on the Manhattan side. "Can you see who lives there?" I asked, remembering one of our old games. You shook your head and rolled your eyes. "Maybe it's a mother and son," I said. Finally, you said, "No, a baseball team." "The whole team, or just a few of them?" "Everyone lives together in the same apartment. It's a big apartment." "They play at night," I said. "They sleep during the day." You broke into a smile. "They eat French fries. Play catch on the roof. But they never fall off." Far below us, the water moved, revealing an umbrella, a mass of plastic bags. The river looked tough, decisive, but it always gave up its secrets.
Now the ferry engine slowed as it approached the dock. A man tossed a rope overboard.
"This is Kowloon," I heard a woman say. We floated to a stop, and I lifted the handle of my suitcase, letting myself be pushed along with the crowd. Soon I would be walking on shore to a new place. The beginning, I knew, was always the best part.
On the bridge above the Harlem River, an ice cream truck had tinkled its song, followed by the snort and stop of a bus. A car had rolled down its window, music pouring out, a woman singing, "Some people want it all."
We had stood and listened on the verge of a summer night. Then you'd cupped your hands around your mouth and leaned over the railing, shouted your name into the air.
I joined you, shouting mine, and we let our voices rise, leaping and echoing, flying over the city. My heart unclenched. You were growing fast. And soon you would be taller than me.
But there was always this game. This song.
We started toward home. The sun coming over the rooftops. And when you began to run, I followed. Feet pounding the sidewalk. Only a moment behind.
21. The third time he played was on a Tuesday night. The opening act out of four, he sat on stage with his acoustic guitar and looper station, which had the backup tracks he'd recorded at home in his room. Outside, what seemed like the 20th snowstorm of the season was grinding up to its chorus, and inside, only one of the tables was occupied, and by members of the next band. A couple had wandered in from the main bar in search of the bathroom and left 10 seconds into Daniel's first song. He'd heard them talking during his short introduction. His name, a hello. He nixed the obligatory quip about the weather. And when they walked out, he had wanted to run off stage after them. He hadn't invited anyone to his shows, though the last time he played, 2 weeks ago, Roland had happened to be walking past the bar and had noticed Daniel's name on the blackboard outside, alarming him by shouting,
"Daniel fucking Wilkinson!"
after the last song.
"Why you being so secretive?"
Roland had said afterwards.
"We hung out 2 days ago and you didn't say anything about playing."
It wasn't about being secretive. It was about self-protection.
"Just say the word and I'll let Dad know and you can put this out. But don't wait too long. No one else is doing stuff like this."
Christmas lights were strung up along the bar's walls. Points of blues and yellows and reds. Daniel heard the guys from the next band talking to one another, caught a glimpse of the bartender playing with her phone. The first two songs came out wobbly, his voice still froggy, the pacing rushed. But by the third song, the one about Deming and his doppelganger, the initial terror had mostly burned off and his playing was steadier, his voice stronger. And he started to feel the words he was singing. Between songs, he paused for enough time to elicit a trace of dry applause from the next band, which made up in enthusiasm what it lacked in volume. What was the compulsion to expose himself so fully? To keep doing something that scared the shit out of him? It hadn't been scary when he'd been playing other people's music, or performing with other people. This was different. Roland had called his songs fresh, crazy honest, the real deal. And after each gig, Daniel thought, "May I never have to do that again." But a few days later, he'd be sending out links to his webpage, trying to book the next one. He made it to the final verse when he looked up at the near-empty room, the fear barging in. "Do the audience a favor," he thought. "Cut the set short." He stumbled, forgetting the next line. The song hung in free fall. He wanted to flee,
to safety and also to humiliation. But knew these were good songs, that he was worthy of being heard. And he hated, more than anything, not being listened to. He remembered the line and the song righted itself, regained its balance. When he finished his set, no one congratulated him. It was the end of another winter, more than a year after Psychic Heart's first show at the Loft Party, and Roland and Nate were recording a full album. Toward the end of February, several days after Angel had deposited his sixth money transfer, she had emailed him. One line, which made him laugh. "The white sheep comes home to roost. A." He was rarely home these days, working at Tres Locos and teaching private guitar lessons to middle schoolers on the Upper West Side. He met up with Roland a few times a week, and on Wednesday and Friday afternoons taught an after-school music class at a community center in Chinatown, where most of his students' families came from Fujian province, and more than a few had also been sent to live with their grandparents until they were old enough to go to school. The Upper West Side kids got frustrated when Daniel tried to teach them how to hold the guitar, and their parents wanted them to be the next Jack White. In their spare time, grades came first. And he looked forward to the days he taught in Chinatown, how the kids there called him Yi Guo, and got excited when they nailed the rhythm of a song. They hadn't yet learned how to be afraid of not looking cool. It was less than 10 blocks from the bar to the subway, but felt farther, carrying his guitar and gear in the sleet, boots skidding along the sidewalk. Across from the subway station was a pizzeria, and he was hungry, but he would wait until he got back to Manhattan. There was food in the refrigerator, and he was becoming a good cook, trading meals with his roommate, perfecting a soup that was a decent rendition of the one at Leon's spot back in Fuzhou. 1 month after his birthday, eating dinner by himself while his mother and Yong were at work, Daniel had come across a picture in an article he was reading online. Lower Broadway on a spring afternoon. Delivery vans and cabs. Halal food carts and fire escapes. That night, for the first time since he had come to China, he listened to the songs he had written over the summer. The music shot through his headphones in silver waves. It was the familiarity of feeling perfectly like himself. He wanted to tweak a few lines, so he typed up some notes, wishing he had his guitar. After he decided to leave, he told his mother that it wasn't about Peter and Kay, that he wasn't choosing them over her. She had cried. The visa form had already been submitted.
"But we'll see each other again," he said.
Leon came with him to the airport, and when Daniel turned at the ticket counter, he saw them from a distance. His mother in her suit and heels, Leon in his sneakers and windbreaker, talking and laughing like old friends. He wasn't sure if he was making the right decision. Didn't know how long he'd stay. Maybe he would come back to Fuzhou after New Year's. Either way, it was incredible to decide something. He had never allowed himself to fully trust his choices before. 3 stops and more than 24 hours of travel later, he arrived at the Syracuse airport the morning of Christmas Day. English clanged out around him in fraught copper lines, and nobody looked Chinese. Outside, waiting for Peter and Kay, it was freezing, and he didn't have a jacket. They parked and got out of the car.
"You must be tired,"
Kay said, hugging him tightly.
"All that flying!"
Peter hugged him too, thumping him on the back. On the drive to Ridgeboro, fighting jet lag, he'd entertained them with light observations about the differences between Fuzhou and New York, talking about traffic and smog, the menu at Pizza Hut, his Speak English Now students, how it didn't snow there. It was that far south. He felt bad, offering Eddie and Tammy and Boss Chung up for amusement. But it seemed easier than having the spotlight on Mama or himself. Back in the house, he skipped out on church and took a nap. And when he woke up, he took his guitar out of the closet. After months of not being played, the strings were still in tune. Moving between chords, his fingers and wrists loosening, he elicited color shifts he'd forgotten about. Brown and aqua, ranges of mauve and pink, the squeakiest of greens. Shit, it felt great. Though he could have sworn there used to be these tiny cracks in the fingerboard that he had wanted to fix but never got around to. Or had he fixed them before he left and forgotten? Peter knocked on the doorframe.
"Reunited at last,"
he said. Daniel looked up.
"Yeah, it's been a while. Still works, though." "Do you notice anything different?"
Peter pointed to the fingerboard.
"I took it to the music department at Carlo, and one of the professors recommended someone he knew. A guitar repairman. I thought it could use a little TLC.
He helped Kay chop vegetables and peel potatoes for dinner.
"I haven't had potatoes in ages,"
he said, as she poured canned pumpkin mix into a pie shell. She was wearing a lavender sweater he hadn't seen before. Peter had a matching one in green.
"We had rice, though. Lots and lots of rice."
Hearing himself in English still felt strange. How easy it would be to say it. "I learned so much when I was there. Let me tell you about her. She had wanted me." But every time he started to say something, he stopped. Kay passed him the pie shell and told him to put it in the oven. He set it down on the rack and closed the door. When he stood up, she was watching him. And he was afraid she would start talking about him going back to Carlo. Or GA meetings. "Was it hard?" she asked. "Being in China." He removed the oven mitt.
"It took a while for my Chinese to come back. But once it did, it got a lot easier."
"But still, it must have been pretty foreign for you." He didn't know why. But he didn't want to tell Kay about how he had always felt a little different there, even if he could speak the language.
"Fuzhou's a big city, though. Real modern."
"Your father and I were reading an article about how women in China are still second-class citizens. It makes sense, I suppose, with the cultural bias against girls." Kay shook her head. "Polly, your birth mother? She must be very brave to have the kind of career she does."
"It's not really like that," he said.
Though she was brave. And in ways Kay didn't know about. And sure, it could be hard for women in China. Harder than it might be for women here. But it bothered him. Talking about Mama like this. When she wasn't here. "It's a shame. Really, when you think of the ways these women might have flourished if they'd had access to the right opportunities in education. They could be doing so much better. So much more."
"She's doing great. A lot of women in China have college degrees."
"Oh, I just had an idea. Maybe I'll talk to someone at Carlo about starting a scholarship for a female Chinese student." She wasn't listening to him. He recalled how she and Peter had insisted on English. His new name. The right education. How better and more hinged on their ideas of success. Their plans. Mama. Chinese. The Bronx. Deming. They had never been enough. He shivered, and for a brief, horrible moment, he could see himself the way he realized they saw him. As someone who needed to be saved.
No.
He felt queasy. Terrified. He balled his hands into fists, pushed them into his pockets. Kay leaned over the oven, checking the timer on the pie. Do you want to make the whipped cream? You always loved doing that. Licking the bowl and all. She took down the mixing bowl from the cabinet. It's good to have you back. I mean, I'm glad you had the opportunity to explore your roots, but I'm also glad you've come home. The house felt lonely without you here. The oven warmed the kitchen, filling it with the scent of baking, sugar and butter and cinnamon. In the living room, Peter had lit a fire, and Daniel could hear the crackling flames, classical music on the stereo. His guitar was upstairs, restrung and repaired, his bed piled with favorite quilts.
It's good to be here, he said,
and got the cream from the refrigerator. He slept for 12 hours, waking up at 4 in the morning, taking long naps in the late afternoon. At dawn, he lay awake in bed, the room slowly sharpening, and remembered walking around Fuzhou with his mother, biking in the park with Yimei, his bumbling first days at the Min Hotel. All of it so peculiar and distant, like someone else's life. He spent the week watching television, barely changing out of his sweatpants or bothering to go outside. On New Year's Eve, Kay and Peter were asleep by 11, and Daniel fell asleep in front of the TV after watching the ball drop in Times Square, pop stars singing to crowds of drunken tourists. He woke up to an infomercial for acne medication. His footsteps muffled by wool socks, he walked around the house in the dark. Even with his eyes closed, he knew he could put a hand out on a wall in any room and have it land exactly on the light switch. That he had to veer to the right of the bookshelf in the living room in order to not bump into the corner of the end table where Kay kept her magazines. That there were 14 steps up to the second floor. Every floorboard, every square inch of the house remained with him. Yet there was so much that this house, that Peter and Kay, would never know. He stood against the kitchen wall, listening to the hum of the refrigerator, the sound of his own breathing. If he couldn't feel at home in China, if he didn't belong in Ridgeboro, then where did that leave him? 3 steps to the dining room, left turn, wall. His growth chart was still here, sketched against the door jamb. There was a dent near the floorboard, made from a basketball he'd once bounced. 5 steps to the china cabinet, its top drawer stuffed with envelopes and postage stamps, old checkbooks, a desiccated rubber band ball. He reached out a hand and closed his eyes. It was home. A home. But he knew he would have to leave here, too. It was a long ride to Harlem from where he had played the show in Brooklyn. Daniel and Michael lived uptown, not only because the rent was more affordable, but because it was closer to Columbia, where Michael stayed late, after his classes, to work in the lab. With the grant money he received, he'd been able to move out of Sunset Park. Daniel trudged up the stairs of the subway station, down the 4 blocks to his building, and up the 5 flights to the apartment. When he unlocked the door, he was glad to see the lights on, and that the place was warm and smelled like food. He unlaced his boots, took off his coat, and put his guitar on his bed. There was no couch, TV, dining room, or kitchen table. They ate on the floor,
using a blanket as a tablecloth. Each of the bedrooms was large enough for a twin bed and nothing else, with space on only one side of the bed to squeeze in and out. And there were no closets, so Daniel had put his box spring up on concrete blocks and stored his clothes in plastic bins underneath. Over the past 3 months, he had replayed his memories of Fuzhou until they lost their potency, leaving only a sense of awe.
I went there. I did that.
Michael's door was open. Daniel knocked on the wall and said,
"What's up, brother?"
in Fuzhonese. Michael was sitting against his bed, eating out of a large bowl.
"Long day at the lab. I'm beat. How was work?"
Daniel switched to English.
"I didn't work tonight. I had a show. I mean, I played a show." "You did? Where?" "At this bar in Brooklyn." "How'd it go?" "Actually, it was really good."
"Why didn't you let me know? I would have come."
"I'll let you know about the next one."
Michael held up his bowl.
"I made food. It's on the stove." "Thanks. I'm starving."
The kitchen, on the opposite end of the apartment, consisted of a two-burner stove, a sink, and a small refrigerator. The dish rack sat on top of the microwave, the cutting board sat on top of the stove, and the rice cooker was on top of the cutting board. Daniel lifted the lid. Steam floated out, along with the sweet, garlicky odor of pork sausage, which Michael had cooked so that it would flavor the rice below. A fried egg awaited him as well. He took out the other bowl, filled it with egg and rice and sausage, and topped it with a spoonful of hot sauce. Sunday nights, he and Michael went to Sunset Park, where they did their laundry in the basement and left the house armed with condiments. When Daniel helped Vivian make dinner, he would think of his mother, in her new apartment, looking at the harbor in the distance.
"I'll visit you in New York,"
she had said in last week's video chat, and he told her he would like that, though he wasn't sure if she could get into the country after being deported. For now, this was where his life would be. This apartment with Michael. This city. His best home. The heater clanked. A siren ripped up the block. He placed the lid back on the rice cooker and took his bowl into the bedroom so he and Michael could eat together. This has been a Highbridge production. Read by Emily Wu Zeller. Copyright 2017 by Lisa Ko. Published by arrangement with Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, a division of Workman Publishing Company, Incorporated. Recording copyright 2017 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.